Chapter 7.
The dough man has her,
said Nightingale, once we were in a taxi and the stern Mrs. Edwards safely well astern.
Mr. Harper said that. The dough man, Mr. Baker. It's a fairly obvious pun.
Even I could see that we would soon be stalking Mr. Baker once more. But I had more important things on my mind. Things that pertain to the future well-being and, let's be honest here, happiness of one Augustus Berrycloth Young, Esquire and expatriate. Why are you so interested in this blasted saxophone? I asked. If the question flustered Nightingale, he showed no sign.
When I showed the saxophone to a friend at the Folly, she grew very upset,
he said.
She wouldn't tell me why, but I got the strong impression that there was some terrible tragedy involved. Naturally, that prompted me to set out to discover what the story behind the instrument was.
And then what? Nightingale gave me the most peculiar smile that seemed to mix determination, excitement, and a sort of distant sadness, which is, I think you'll agree, a bally lot of work for a single expression to do. I can only manage my expressions to mean one thing at a time. But then, I suppose nobody has ever marked me out as a man of destiny.
I had the receipt and I remembered that you were sojourning here, so I booked a liner over,
he said. A cold hand gripped my chest as a horrendous thought surfaced like a submarine stalking an unsuspecting steamer. Do the old sticks at the Folly know you are here? I asked.
Certainly,
said Nightingale.
I posted a letter explaining the whole op just as soon as I was safely berthed in New York.
You sent them a letter? I cried, as if struck by torpedoes amidships.
You think I should have sent a telegram instead?
I think it's dashed rummy of you to drag me into your bally investigation, letting me think it was authorised at the highest level, I said. I think it's damned hypocritical of you.
This is not about playing pranks on policemen and larks at Goodwood,
said Nightingale with some heat.
At the heart of this matter, real people may be suffering, and I believe that as keepers of the secret flame, we have a duty to act.
Who do you think is suffering? I asked, and didn't add, apart from myself and Lucy, who had had extensive plans for the weekend. And why do you think that?
I don't know,
said Nightingale.
I only know that the saxophone deeply distressed my friend, and I have never known her to be distressed in such a dire manner before. She made it very clear that she expected me to act.
And who is this friend? I asked. But already the hungry pike of suspicion was nibbling at the brightly coloured lure of my memory. Or do you catch pike with worms? I've never been much of a fisherman. Let us just say that the suspicious pike was damned hungry and leave it at that.
I'd rather not say,
said Nightingale. Wait, I said, having paused only to bash the pike of suspicion firmly with the mallet of certainty. You're not talking about that queer scullery maid at the Folly, the one with all the teeth.
Her name,
said Nightingale slowly,
is Molly.
You have me tussling with mobsters, ne'er-do-wells, and sarcastic millionaires because... I was about to say a scullery maid again, but Nightingale's face had taken on a dangerous stillness. Of Molly?
Yes,
said Nightingale.
Will that be a problem?
There was what the novelists are pleased to call a pregnant pause. No, I said. I just needed it clarified. Once we had arrived at the safety of my flat, I retired pointedly to my room, exchanged my street garments for my green silk dressing gown, and took up station at the window seat. From there, I looked over Washington Square, the Imitation Arc de Triomphe, and north up Fifth Avenue towards Central Park. Beyond the park was Harlem and Lucy, and I wanted both, although, had push come to shove, I would have settled for Lucy. Still, if life has taught me one thing, it is that not everything one wants will just fall into one's lap. Occasionally, one must exert oneself to achieve one's goals, and if this means solving the mystery of the missing mystery girl, then so be it.
Prouver que j'ai raison, serait accorder que je puis avoir tort,
As Monsieur Chastain, my old French master, and the first of the many unrequited loves of my life, was fond of saying. Now, chaps who know me will know that I am partial to a good mystery novel. Lucy often loudly laments my choice of reading material. He is forever thrusting the likes of Edith Wharton or Jean Toomer into my hands. So far, the only one I've really enjoyed was This Side of Paradise by that Fitzgerald chap, although the ending was a touch depressing.
At least they contain important lessons for how we live our lives, Lucy had told me more than once.
So it was with some satisfaction that I turned to one of the many lessons taught to me from my close perusal of the works of Christie, Sayers, and Hammett. For example, I don't know if you, too, are an aficionado of mystery novels, but at about the halfway mark, the detective will refresh his memory of the case. Sometimes the blighters write it down, other times they recount the facts to the hapless sidekick, or, if one is not available, the audience. Item 1. The Reverend Edwards met a mysterious girl while serving overseas. Item the second. The girl, Morel, followed him back to Harlem and gave him an enchanted saxophone. For a while all was well, but Edwards began to feel trapped, which his wife says drove him to drink or heroin. He pawns the saxophone and takes up religion. Item the third. The formidable Mrs. Edwards says that Morel got her hooks into Mr. Baker, the club owner. He himself makes no mention of this, but Lloyd Beaumont, the pianist, remembers a tall, pale woman in a veil wandering around the club and dancing backstage during the sets. If this frail was anything like Nightingale's alarming scullery maid, then she was definitely what we in the magical trade call a fae. I was taught a long and complicated definition back at school, which I no longer remember, but the gist was that they were like men, or women in this case, only different, and sometimes inherently magical. I only remember that much, because the subject was taught by Monsieur Chastain, so I paid rather more attention to the subject than I might otherwise have. At one end were the high fae, the gentry who lived in castles, had banquets, and placed unbreakable guirassa on unsuspecting questing knights who, if they ever existed, were now gone from the land. Less remarkable, but more common, were the middle fae, the brownies, wefkins, boggarts, falloys, ballyhoos, and a dozen other types I've forgotten the names of. At the bottom of the pile came the goblins, of which there were 100 types that nobody cared to learn the names of. Unlike Berrycloth Young here, Monsieur Chastain had said, the fae do not have to strain or work for their magic. It comes naturally to them. The high fae are, of course, the most powerful, but one should never underestimate even the lowliest goblin. Can anyone tell me what goblins are famous for? I cannot, but I remember Monsieur Chastain had magnificent hands. I also remember that Monsieur Chastain spoke of the higher fae possessing certain talents. One was enchantment, the ability to imbue physical objects with magical power, and a second was the ability to walk the fairy roads, allowing them to pass quickly from one location to another. Morel had exhibited both qualities, so, quod eros demonstrandum, was most likely a superior fae from France or Belgium. Also, QED, if I'm using the Latin correctly, she could leave America at any time. Perhaps she liked it here, despite Edwards proving a bust. Expending that much sheer brain power might have winded a lesser man, but we Berrycloth Youngs, as I have said before, laugh in the face of intellectual exertion. I had an objective, the elusive and mendacious Mr. Baker. Now all I needed was an address. As if summoned by my thoughts, Beauregard insinuated himself into the room, bearing another brandy and soda. Beauregard, I said.
Sir?
You're a man of the city, I said.
To be completely accurate, sir, I was born and raised in New Orleans,
said Beauregard. Oh, I said, I didn't know that.
No reason why you should, sir.
Decent place.
New Orleans?
Yes.
A trifle hard and somewhat fraught on occasion, said Beauregard. However, I believe that you, and indeed Mr. Gibbs, might find it of interest from a musicological point of view.
The notion of an immediate escape southwards with Lucy was an appealing one, but never let it be said that we Berrycloth Youngs are not remorselessly single-minded in our pursuit of whatever it is we're supposed to be pursuing at the time, even if this is merely a good tip for the 415 at Newmarket. What I meant, I said, is that you are a man who knows what's what in the city, a man with his finger on the pulse, the warp and woof of human affairs.
I endeavour to stay abreast of events, sir.
So, if I were to say to you, for example, could you find the home address of Stephen Baker, proprietor of the Alexandra nightclub, would that be within the scope of your undoubtedly extensive talents?
Mr. Baker has a rather fine townhouse on East 18th Street.
Good God, Beauregard, I cried. Did you just know that off the top of your head?
I have a cousin on my mother's side who was in service with this household, said Beauregard. She left under unfortunate circumstances, so the details have rather stuck in my mind.
What kind of unfortunate circumstances?
I'd rather not say, sir,
said Beauregard.
Will sir be venturing out this afternoon?
I rather think we will be, I said. Pick out something sturdy, just in case.
Very good, sir.
It was, as Beauregard had noted, a very fine townhouse indeed. Nightingale and I had formulated a plan of action during our walk over from Washington Square. Dutifully, I trotted up the front steps, while Nightingale descended into the basement area to try the tradesman's entrance. I was met at the door by a tall white man in an old-fashioned butler's garb and with an old-fashioned but familiar accent.
"Good afternoon,"
he intoned. "Good afternoon," I said cheerily. "I'm here to see Mr. Baker. Is he in?"
"Do you have an appointment?"
he said, in tones redolent of the better parts of the old home metropolis. "I'm afraid not," I said, "but it is a matter of some urgency." I presented my card to the man, who glanced at it, and no doubt swayed by the superior quality of the card stock and printing, ushered me into the parlour while he inquired after his master's availability. I have to say, it was a very handsome parlour in the modern deco style, and had I been the kind of chap who kept a notebook, I certainly would have taken notes against furnishing a future flat. I was just admiring a particularly sleek, cream-coloured sofa when the screaming started. A short, sharp, masculine yelp of surprise and panic, followed by a clattering sound that might have been caused by pots and pans and other kitchenware slamming against a wall with some force before falling down onto a stone floor. Beneath the mundane sounds, I could sense the mesmerizing, metronomic tick-tock of Nightingale's signare. He had warned me that it might come to this, so I reluctantly abandoned my admiration of the parlour's furnishings and stepped out into the entrance hall. I took a grip on my cane, which can be a great comfort to a wizard, not least because it can serve as a blunt instrument in times of need. There was a sound akin to an elephant hurrying up the back stairs, a cry of alarm, and a florid, thick-set man in a natty yellow and red embroidered waistcoat burst from a concealed door and into the hall. He slammed the door behind him and only then turned in my direction. At the sight of me, he took a step backwards. "Get back!" he yelled, his face turning as red as a beetroot. "Excuse me," I said, "are you Mr. Baker?" "Get back, damn you," he shouted and lunged. I skipped backwards, ready to cast a spell if need be, but the fellow tripped over his own feet without any assistance from me and fell flat on his face. For a second, he struggled to stand, but then he slumped back down again, clutching at his nose. Nightingale appeared in the hallway with the butler behind him.
"Mr. Baker," said Nightingale, "you've had a fall. Here, let me help you."
he gently wrestled Mr. Baker into a sitting position, revealing a surprisingly large amount of blood leaking from his nose. The butler gave a restrained grunt of surprise and stepped forward, only to be met by Nightingale's outstretched hand.
"Some warm water and clean napkins,"
he said,
"if you don't mind."
With my assistance, we helped Mr. Baker into the parlour where, unfortunately, he got blood on his nice, clean, tan-coloured carpet. We sat him on the deco sofa and Nightingale solicitously tugged Mr. Baker's hand away and examined his nose. He declared that it was clearly not broken and handed the poor man his handkerchief to stem the flow. Throughout these ministrations, Mr. Baker's eyes were wide with fear as he looked first at me, then at Nightingale, and back again. At one point they rolled back into his head, and I feared he was about to faint. Nightingale can be a fearsome customer, but I couldn't help feeling that this alarm was overdone. When the butler returned with a bowl, towels, and napkins, Nightingale dealt with the injury himself, while shooing the man away to fetch tea and something stronger for his master. Once tea and brandy had been served, Mr. Baker was calmed sufficiently to recover some of his composure and demanded to know who we were and what we thought we were doing.
"Who did you think we were?"
asked Nightingale. "I have no idea," said Mr. Baker.
"Then why did you run away?"
"I thought you were assassins," said Mr. Baker.
"Who would want to assassinate you and why?"
The question seemed to spark outrage in Mr. Baker, who spluttered that he had made many enemies, so of course he was worth assassinating. How dare we insinuate that he wasn't worth killing? The nerve, the effrontery.
"Did you take us for gangsters, then?"
asked Nightingale. Mr. Baker went to shake his head, winced, and gingerly touched his nose. The bleeding had stopped, but it had begun to swell. "No," he said. "There are worse things than honest gangsters in this city."
"Can you give them a name?"
"I don't know names," he said. "I take care not to know names. It's much safer not to know names."
"I see,"
said Nightingale.
"Tell us about Morel."
"Who's that?"
"Pearly Edwards' lover,"
said Nightingale.
"The pale, quiet woman who I believe stayed with you for a while."
"Was that her name?"
"So the Reverend Edwards said."
"She never said." Mr. Baker giggled and caught himself. "I didn't know."
"Did she stay with you?"
"Did she fuck my brains out, you mean?" he said. "Damn right she did. Morning, noon, and night. Fucking was all she was interested in, except those hinky instruments." Mr. Baker's wife had been visiting relatives in the Midwest, or he never would have allowed the situation to develop as it did. As it was, it lasted less than 6 weeks before Mr. Baker was forced to pass her on.
"When was this?"
asked Nightingale. 5 years previously, 2 years before he'd bought the Alexandra, when he was still in partnership with Mark Harper in Tin Pan Alley. "How did you meet the Reverend Edwards?" I asked. Mr. Baker snorted and muttered "Reverend" under his breath. His face had less of the beet vegetable about it, although I noticed his nose retained its ruddy complexion. "I bought some sheet music off him," he said. "Anything I'd have heard of?" I asked, ignoring a quizzical glance from Nightingale. Mr. Baker named a number of titles, several of which I recognized from my dancing days in London. They were all what Lucy might call the tamest sweet dance tunes, and all hits for white performers, although before I met Lucy, I doubt I would have made such a distinction. Another thing I had learned from Lucy was how the music business was conducted in America. "Did you buy the full rights?" I asked. "Not that it's any business of yours, but yes, obviously. Only a fool publishes anything that he doesn't have exclusive rights to," said Mr. Baker, with such an air of smugness that I had a most ungentlemanly urge to strike him around the head. Mr. Baker would have made thousands off that music and paid Edwards a pittance. "Was Mr. Harper cut in on this deal?" I asked. "Like I said," said Mr. Baker, "only a fool shares any rights he doesn't need to. Mark never rated these colored composers. He thought they were only good for jigaboo music and minstrel songs. His loss," Mr. Baker sniffed. "His loss." Nightingale caught my eye and raised an eyebrow. He wanted to know whether I'd quite finished with my detour through the iniquities of music publishing. As I believe I have demonstrated previously, Nightingale can make his expressions do a great deal of work. I opened my hand to indicate that it was his turn on the third degree carousel.
"Now see here, Baker,"
he said in his most authoritative voice, which was pretty damned authoritative, I can tell you.
"When Guzzy here presented you with my card, you immediately attempted to leg it out of the basement. Now you've never had the pleasure of Gussie's company, but had met me, and I had given you my name. So what was it about my name that had you fleeing for your life?"
The confidence that had been returning to Mr. Baker's demeanour drained away, but he said nothing.
"Now I believe I was perfectly pleasant the last time we met,"
said Nightingale, in a tone that strongly implied that alternatives to pleasant could be arranged at short notice.
"And the only thing I asked you about was an enchanted saxophone, so I can only assume that that was the cause of your apprehension."
Mr. Baker looked blank, and then gave me a pleading look. "Are you scared of us because of the magic saxophone?" I said. "Not you," he said. "I'm scared of what you might bring down on my head." Chapter 8. I won't bore you with the detailed recitation of the rest of the conversation. Nightingale, who on occasion has worked with real police detectives, has told me that effective interrogations are never like what you read about in crime stories. A proper interrogation involves patience and concentration on the part of the questioners, not qualities I am much noted for. Suffice to say, I left most of the hard work to Nightingale while I investigated the contents of Mr. Baker's drinks cabinet and his cigarette box. From these, I learnt two things. One, that the parlour was certainly exclusively for entertaining unwanted guests, and secondly, that no matter how much vermouth you pour in bathtub gin, it tastes like bathtub gin. Still, when I served it up to Mr. Baker, it seemed to lubricate his tongue well enough. It was the week before Christmas 1921 when Mr. Baker turned Morell out onto the street. He had no choice. Not only was his wife of 15 years returning within days, but the woman had started to show. "That dumb frail had let that jungle bunny get her basted, so there was no way I was keeping that around," said Mr. Baker.
"Truly, you are a prince amongst men," said Nightingale.
He put the little moocher out of his mind until later the next year, when the Bruno, known far and wide as the horse, had turned up on his doorstep. A bit of further questioning revealed that this was Mr. Clydesdale of the musical voice, although Mr. Baker didn't know why he was called the horse. Obviously, the legend of that proud Scottish equine had yet to reach the New World. The horse wanted to know where the woman had come from and if she'd made any other instruments, and had he, Mr. Baker, noticed any unusual effects when she attended soirees, clubs, or parties. "I said I'd never taken her to any soirees, nightclubs, or parties," said Mr. Baker, and that was it, for the time being. The next year, Mr. Baker had bought out the Alexandra, and at this point went on a long diatribe complaining bitterly that Oni, the killer, Madden, had got the idea of a whites-only Harlem cabaret club from him. "Bastard used all that hooch, though, to buy up the talent for the Cotton Club." The Alexandra did okay, though, and provided a steady stream of hopefuls for Mr. Baker's publishing business to exploit. He was going up in the world and could afford the house we were currently sitting in, a genuine English butler and a second, younger, more adventurous wife. Then the horse paid him a visit at the club. "Charles Yeager sent his compliments and asked that I allow his employees occasional access to the club," Mr. Baker told us. And of course he acquiesced, because what Charles Yeager wanted, he got. "He's in deep with the cops, the DA, the gangsters, and bootleggers. Not so deep that he risks a fight, but deep enough that they do him favors. Old money, you know.
They walk past you with their noses in the air, but they have their feet on the gutter, and they know how to pull the strings.
But it seemed a small enough burden. 3 or 4 times a month, the horse would turn up with the woman in tow, and she would sit hidden behind the orchestra or in the back.
You were sure it was Morel?
Asked Nightingale.
Who?
Asked Mr. Baker, but then,
yeah, Pearlie's woman. She was wearing a veil, but I knew it was her. The way she moved, the way she danced, like she was listening to music you couldn't hear.
It seemed an easy, trivial arrangement until Mr. Baker started to notice a disturbing pattern.
She was a curse, said Mr. Baker.
It was so subtle, at first he didn't see it. Show business is a fickle enterprise. Audiences can be unexpectedly tetchy for no apparent reason. Dancers can sprain their ankles or forget their moves. Musicians can have a bad night, and you can easily find yourself with a bad batch of booze. Especially these days, I said, thinking of the gin in his drinks cabinet. The coloured staff complained first, the scrubbers and the waitresses, and he dismissed their talk of curses as superstition and hoodoo. But as if their complaints had opened his eyes, Mr. Baker began to discern a pattern whereby the bulk of these misfortunes occurred on the nights when the veiled lady was in attendance. And the problems multiplied and grew worse. Top performers wouldn't even consider the Alexandra, no matter what Mr. Baker offered them. Last year, things had come to a head. The Cotton Club had been closed down, and while everybody knew that Oni Madden would shortly grease enough palms to get it reopened, this, nevertheless, was the Alexandra's chance, Mr. Baker's chance, to retake some of that lucrative white downtown trade. So he told the horse on the very next visit that he and the veiled lady were no longer welcome.
As you wish, said the horse,
and the very next day the police raided the club, and the Alexandra was shut down for 6 months.
But it was worth it, said Mr. Baker, to get rid of that woman.
And he still lived in fear of the horse and of other less easily defined threats.
I didn't used to believe in hoodoo, said Mr. Baker, but now I know it's real. You can see them witches and hoodoo doctors walking around bold as brass. And another thing, most of them are white, so you can't see them coming.
Is that who you thought we were?
Asked Nightingale, with an amused gleam in his eye.
Witch doctors.
Ain't you?
Asked Mr. Baker.
We're professionals,
said Nightingale.
Do you know what happened to Morel after you exiled her for a second time?
I hear she haunts the faggot balls, said Mr. Baker. Nobody gives a shit what happens there.
Nightingale nodded, thanked Mr. Baker for his time, and it was not until we were safely clear of the house and looking for a cab that he turned to me and asked,
What on earth is a faggot ball?
Confusingly, faggot, in case you don't know, is a rude American word for homosexuals. So when that word is used, you shouldn't expect a roaring fire or a tasty northern dumpling, or at least not in the way you may be used to. A type of fancy dress ball, I said, a sort of masquerade where people come as themselves, and then tried to bite my tongue.
They masquerade as themselves?
Asked Nightingale. As they might want to dress up once in a while.
Do you and Mr. Gibbs attend these events?
Many people do, I said. A trifle evasively, I must admit. Many of the top people in the city come to watch the spectacle.
Do you happen to know when the next such event is scheduled?
Such a dangerous question. Of course I did. But I daren't appear too knowledgeable. Then suddenly I conceived of a cunning but subtle wheeze that would dampen suspicion and allow myself to cheese it away from Nightingale, at least for an evening. Not off the top of my head, I said, but I'm sure Lucien will know whom to ask.
Excellent,
said Nightingale.
Why don't you contact Mr. Gibbs straight away while I pursue other lines of inquiry?
If I must, I said, and tried to keep the skip out of my step. Alas, my pleasant evening with Lucy did not get off to a good start, as when I arrived at his flat, I found he was already entertaining a number of police officers. I should have noticed the pair of flivvers parked outside, but my thoughts were of amore, not jura. So, the first I knew of it was when I walked in to find Lucy's parlour full of heavy-set men in navy blue tunics. One of the brutes popped out of the kitchen as I let myself in.
"Well, look who's here,"
he exclaimed in all too happy fashion. In the living room, I found Lucy sitting on his sofa, sandwiched between two beefy, red-faced specimens. He looked wan and stared at me with pleading in his eyes. Sitting in Lucy's reading chair, the high-backed leather monster I had bought him as an anniversary gift because he constantly complained about his back, was a vast, corpulent toad of a man, uniform tunic undone, to reveal a crisp white shirt straining over his paunch, a glass generously filled with my Canadian whiskey in his hand. An open bottle of the same stood on the occasional table beside him. This was Sergeant Bracknell, and our paths had crossed before. His pink face and squinty blue eyes raised in me an instant desire to belabor him about the head with my cane. Unlike Nightingale's, my expressions are often distressingly obvious, and my anger must have shown because as I stepped forward to confront him, I felt one of his constabulary confederates grasp my upper arm in a firm grip.
"Whoa there, boy," said Sergeant Bracknell. "You're thinking I won't shoot a white man, but you being a fag in English to boot means I wouldn't think twice."
He gave me an unpleasant leer.
"I could always say that your girlfriend here shot you in a jealous rage. Everybody knows how jealous you queens get."
"Do they?" I said. "Gosh." For some reason, this perfectly anodyne response seemed to anger the lumpen sergeant and cause Lucy to mouth "shut the fuck up" at me. The first time Sergeant Bracknell had busted Lucy and me had been when we were attending a pleasant little concert with friends in a basement speakeasy on 7th Avenue, although speakeasy was probably far too grand a term for what was clearly someone's parlour. His men kicked down the door, battered the host around the shoulders, and demanded that we empty our wallets. Sergeant Bracknell supervised and intoned that this was an illegal gathering under the Volstead Act and numerous New York City ordinances, but didn't even attempt to make it sound legitimate.
"He must have needed the spinach in a hurry,"
Lucy said later.
"Usually he likes to stick around and have some fun first."
This seems to have been the case, because after a perfunctory search, the coppers made off with the contents of our pockets, but not our watches or the crate of top-quality gin hidden in the cupboard beneath the stairs. It's a funny thing, but often when some lout commits an outrage on your person, in this case demanding money with menaces, it can take a peculiarly long time for you to get your dander up. As it was, Sergeant Bracknell had time to walk up the area steps and reach the street before the dam broke. A red mist descended, and I set forth to teach the blighter a lesson he wouldn't forget. Lucy jumped me and, with the aid of some friends, wrestled me to the ground.
"They're the police,"
he hissed.
"There's nothing you can do."
"We'll see about that," I exclaimed. But Lucy sat on me and kept talking until the words sank in. You couldn't fight the police. Dispose of Sergeant Bracknell and he would immediately be replaced by someone new and probably worse. In addition, it would be a trivial thing for them to arrest us, beat us, and send us to Welfare Island, which apparently was something not to be desired. It was only because they could squeeze us for cash that they restrained themselves from beating us to death.
"You cannot fight back,"
said Lucy,
"unless you want to fight the whole state."
So I have learnt to keep my temper under control the half a dozen times Bracknell or his ilk have shaken us down, as they say in New York. I have buttoned up my rage and kept my counsel in the face of extreme provocation, which is, I might say, one of the principal skills one acquires at a British public school. And now here we were with Bracknell again. I didn't think the evening could get any worse until one of the police officers returned with the dress. It was a magnificent dress in blue chiffon, cut knee-length and sleeveless in the modern style, with clusters of beads and silver thread sewn in flowing geometric patterns. It was the work of the legendary Madame Zaza, and it, along with the shoes, had cost me an eye-watering sum. Sergeant Bracknell seized the dress and, leaping to his feet, held it up to his neck, as if trying it in front of a mirror. His free hand stroked the fabric with an unpleasant lasciviousness, and his eyes lit up with a strange glee.
"Oh, isn't this lovely?" he said. "This must have cost a pretty penny, too much for a boy like Lucy to afford. There are girls down on Fifth Avenue who would get on their knees for a dress like this."
He turned to wink at his uniformed cronies, who dutifully laughed.
"And I don't mean to pray, either."
He frowned and looked from me to Lucy.
"Wait," he said. "This isn't for him, is it?"
He advanced upon me with the dress thrust out like a wardrobe mistress, sizing up an understudy. With exaggerated delicacy, he proffered it to me and stepped back as I held the straps to my shoulders. The dress was a perfect fit. Of course it was.
"So now we know who is the lady of the house," he said,
and coming close, leered into my face.
"Got the jungle fever, do you?"
Now, as has been elucidated ad nauseam, I am not the brainiest of chaps, but I was suddenly filled with an icy certainty that, rather than a routine bust, this particular visit was a different kind of business altogether. This was an act of intimidation. But to what purpose?
"Maybe,"
said Bracknell, standing even closer,
"you should give us a show."
He ran a hand down the length of the dress, smoothing it against my chest, waist, and hip. Then, to make this a true red-letter day for the berry-cloth young bean, I had a second awful realization. Bracknell was jealous. He wanted the dress for himself. "What is it you really want?" I asked. Now, whether Bracknell took my first or second meaning, I do not know. But it was enough to make him pull away and leave me with the dress. One of his men tittered nervously like a schoolboy toadying to an older boy, which earned him a glare from his superior. When Bracknell turned back to me, all trace of his hitherto gay, playful humour had vanished. He was all business.
"You've been poking your nose in matters that don't concern you," he said. "Do it again, and we'll cut your nose off."
He glanced at Lucy.
"Or something worse. Am I making myself clear?"
I told him, croakily, that he was perfectly clear. After which, he left, but not before trousering all the good booze and spare cash he could find. He left the dress, thank God, and had seemingly overlooked the matching shoes, still in their box, in Lucy's wardrobe. I stood in the centre of the room and shook with impotent rage, while Lucy ensured the front door was locked and bolted. Then he put his arms around me until the shaking subsided. I had to clench my teeth to keep from howling.
"I know,"
said Lucy.
"I know."
I was about to suggest that we should rehang the dress before it got crumpled, when a young coloured woman came storming into the living room, brandishing a revolver. "I swear," she said, "one day I'm going to lure that motherfucker out to the docks and put him in the East River." She casually dropped the revolver on the mantelpiece next to the ormolu clock and smiled at me. "Gussie," she said, "where's your ritzy friend?" There was something dashed familiar about her face, the smile in particular. "Do I know you?" I asked.
"This is my cousin Amelia," said Lucy. "You remember her from New Year's Eve?"
Only in fragments, which I thought was both clever and funny, and I would have elaborated on the joke if the swiftly moving omnibus of recognition hadn't unexpectedly turned the corner of memory and struck me forcibly in the ribs. Her complexion was a shade darker and her eyes larger, but she was, unmistakably, the white girl who'd sidled up to us at the Alexandra and driven us home from Long Island. Coco, I said.
Really, Lucy, did you have to choose such a slow man to share your fast life? She said.
He can do magic, said Lucy.
Can he? Said Amelia. That would explain some things.
But, I said, which I admit lacked a certain je ne sais quoi, but luckily Amelia got the gist.
I am a chameleon, Gussie, said Amelia. Like Dr. Jekyll, I transform into a hideous monster who prowls the nightclub searching for my prey. Do you read weird tales? Since you do magic, I would have thought it an appropriate entertainment.
She passes,
said Lucy, which left me no wiser than before. Now, you would have thought, my being famously deficient, that two staggering insights within the space of an hour would be enough. But listening to Amelia, nay Coco, chattering on about her magazine reading, it occurred to me that her reaction to learning I could do magic had been wrong. If she believed Lucy, she should have asked for a demonstration. And if she didn't, or thought he meant stage magic, she should have still asked for a demonstration, or at least proof. Her incurious response was, well, not to belabor the point, curious. I would have laid odds of 3-1 that Amelia already knew all about the magic, probably all about Nightingale and me. Ha! That's what the business with the Gasper at the Alexandra had been all about. She'd obviously been hoping that a flash cove like Nightingale would give himself away by lighting it by magic. Fat chance of that. This intelligence would have to be passed on to Nightingale, but right then I needed a reviving beverage. Fortunately, the original owner of the flat had been a smuggler, or a revolutionary, or an anarchist, or all three, and had installed a false wall in the pantry, with quite a commodious store hidden behind. Commodious enough for Amelia to hide in when the police arrived for tea and intimidation, and with sufficient additional space to stock a demijohn of Harlem gin. I prepared a jug, pouring plenty of lime and soda to smother the taste, and we all sat down in the living room like civilized people to recover our nerves. Once I was recovered enough to face the prospect of speaking to Nightingale, I called my flat on Lucy's telephone. When Beauregard answered, he informed me that Master Nightingale had returned for a light afternoon tea and a change of clothes before heading out once more. Did he say where he was going?
I'm afraid he did not see fit to confide in me, sir, said Beauregard. However, he did ask me from which station he might catch a train to Manhasset Station.
Is that on Long Island?
I believe so, sir.
And how was he attired for this outing?
A rather fetching pair of sporting plus fours, unfortunately matched with somewhat drab gaiters, boots, and a coat, which at best could be called utilitarian.
Was he armed?
Only with the pistol, sir,
said Beauregard.
A Webley self-loading Mark I, if I'm not mistaken, worn high on the chest in a gunner's holster.
Concealed under the coat?
Of course, sir.
Thank you, Beauregard.
Will sir be returning tonight?
No, I shall be bunking down at Lucien's, I said. The rest of the evening is your own.
Thank you, sir,
said Beauregard. I returned to the others and conveyed only that Nightingale had stepped out for the evening. Did he say where he was going? Asked Amelia. I told her I was afraid not, which appeared to vex her, although she put on a brave face. Suspiciously, soon afterwards, she gathered her coat and bid us a good night. I sat on the sofa next to Lucy, and he put his head on my shoulder. Nightingale wanted to know what a faggot ball was, I said, which made Lucy chuckle.
Good God, he said suddenly. You don't think he plans to attend?
I'm hoping we will be done with this business before Saturday.
Let's hope so.
Lucy entwined his fingers in mine and raised my hand to kiss the back.
Madame Zaza will never forgive us if we don't wear that dress, he said.
Chapter 9. Nightingale arrived early the next morning, cruelly interrupting Lucy and me as we were enjoying a pleasant and well-earned sojourn in bed.
Good, you're still here,
said Nightingale, as he swept into the hallway. as described by Beauregard last night. He was dressed for shooting or fishing or some other equally rural pursuit in plus fours and a khaki jacket festooned with pockets, and sporting a leather knapsack. He divested himself of his jacket and stared down at the mud which encrusted his boots and gaiters. Sighing, he sat on the ornamental bench by the coat rack and began to unlace himself.
"Mr. Gibbs," he said, "I couldn't trouble you for a clothes brush, could I?"
Now, I knew that Lucy owned a complete set of clothes brushes and all the other accoutrements that a gentleman needs to maintain proper standards of dress, because they'd been a Valentine's gift the previous February, and perhaps one day he will trouble himself to use them. Still, they came in useful that morning. The pristine nature of the brush Lucy handed him was not lost on Nightingale.
"It almost seems a shame to get it dirty,"
he said, while I laid down old newspaper to catch the mud. "How was Long Island?" asked Lucy.
"Frustrating,"
said Nightingale.
"I have encountered military bases with fewer sentries, although I did manage to get close enough to meet our mysterious Morel."
Despite the high wall, the gate, and the regular patrols, it had been much easier than Nightingale had initially expected. Around sunset, he spotted a lone female figure walking the perimeter of the grounds. There seemed to be no guards or other attendants trailing her, so Nightingale had made an estimate of speed and direction of travel and risked scaling the walls at a point where trees created convenient cover on both sides. He jumped down only to find her waiting for him.
"Gave me a start," said Nightingale, "I can tell you."
"And?" I asked.
"She's definitely a fae of some kind. Tall, slender, plenty of teeth."
"The same as your friend Molly?"
"Similar,"
said Nightingale.
"A different tribe, perhaps, or clan, or nation. We still don't know how they organize themselves."
"Hasn't your friend told you?" I asked, but Nightingale ignored me.
"We communicated after a fashion," he said. "I believe I conveyed the notion that she should flee with me on the instant, but she was reluctant. Kept looking back at the house, to me, and back again. Then she shook her head and fled back to the house. I would have gone after her, only a patrol was approaching and I was forced to retreat."
He critically examined the boot he was holding before placing it carefully on the paper and moving on to the next one.
"This is what I don't understand,"
he said.
"If I could make it over that wall, so could she. If she could travel across the Atlantic to be with Pearly Edwards, then surely she could travel the other way to escape."
"Perhaps she's not dissatisfied with her situation," I said.
"That was not my impression."
"Perhaps Jaeger has something on her," said Lucy. "Something she couldn't abandon."
"What are you thinking?"
asked Nightingale, who, having finished brushing his boots, stood up.
"Gussie told me that Baker said that Pearlie had got her basted,"
said Lucy.
"What if there's a child?"
We repaired to the kitchen where I made tea using the leaves I import at almost as ruinous a cost as my booze, although at least Sergeant Bracknell wouldn't think to confiscate this.
"It's a possibility,"
said Nightingale.
"And it would certainly explain why she wouldn't leave the estate."
"I thought they were not attached to their progeny," I said. "Certainly Monsieur Chastain of the Beautiful Hands had taught me that. The denizens of the demi-monde, particularly the fae, could be distinguished from civilized men by this very lack of filial loyalty."
"I'm afraid a great deal of what we were taught at Casterbrook about the demi-monde and the wider world was wrong,"
said Nightingale.
"It is entirely possible that Morel might be attached to her child, if there is one."
"You think Baker lied?" I asked.
"Only if he was opening and closing his mouth," said Lucy.
"Or just ignorant,"
said Nightingale.
"That too," said Lucy, and the two exchanged smiles.
"Certainly I will need more solid intelligence before we mount a raid on Mr. Jaeger's estate,"
said Nightingale.
"A raid?"
I'll admit I said this more as a squeak than an exclamation.
"Did you discover when the next of these faggot balls is taking place?"
"Tomorrow night," said Lucy. "It's the spring masquerade at the Roxy Ballroom."
"Do you think she'll attend?"
I asked. It's the biggest drag ball other than the Hamilton Lodge ball, and that's been and gone, said Lucy, while not mentioning that so had we.
Yes, but to what purpose is her attendance? I asked.
I knew why Lucy and I attended. I knew why the downtown Gorpers attended. But it seemed dashed odd to me that an obviously powerful fae would gain anything from the experience.
Presumably the same purpose as her visits to the Alexandra,
said Nightingale.
Why at this moment is not important. We shall work on the assumption that on Saturday night she will be away from the Jaeger estate. As well, I suspect, Mr. Clydesdale and a number of Mr. Jaeger's retainers. If there is a child held there, that would be the moment to rescue it.
Are you seriously suggesting that we mount a raid on the estate of one of the most powerful men in New York? The squeak had distressingly returned to my voice.
Of course not,
said Nightingale.
I will stage that rescue. Your mission will be to liberate Morel from her handlers at the ball.
No, said Lucy, with some force. Assuming you survive, you will be quickly on a steamer back to England. But if Gussie and I are in any way implicated in this kidnap, we will face terrible retribution. Gussie is too good-hearted and too obedient to refuse, but I will not let you drag him into this reckless folly.
Nightingale's faint smile only served to incense him further. Do you find me amusing, sir?
No,
said Nightingale.
You're right, of course. It would be churlish to expose Gussie so. If need be, I can handle both rescues. I only ask for a safe haven for Morel and, if there is one, her child. The flat on Washington Square would serve admirably.
And if he refuses, said Lucy, glancing at me.
Understand this, gentlemen,
said Nightingale.
I will attempt this rescue with or without your help. I will leave it to your consciences as to how much assistance you might care to render. But at the very least, I beg your help ascertaining whether there is a child or not. Is there a city hospital that she might have attended?
Lucy sat back and folded his arms and kept a suspicious eye on Nightingale. Of course, I said. A girl like that would have stood out, what with the teeth and all.
You keep mentioning the teeth, said Lucy. What on earth is wrong with her teeth?
His lively curiosity had obviously overruled his attempt at stern disapproval. It's difficult to say, I said. If they're anything like Thomas's friend Molly, then they will be perfectly respectable in many respects, very white, very even, only when she smiles, there seem to be a greater number of them than one might expect, and they're sharper.
She has fangs?
Asked Lucy. Fangs might be overstating the matter, I said.
If,
Nightingale hesitated and then continued,
if I am to attempt a rescue on Saturday, we need to confirm the child's existence before the ball, preferably today.
I don't see how that's possible, I said.
Midwives, said Lucy suddenly. I doubt Mr. Jaeger would have delivered the baby himself.
A house that big will have maids,
said Nightingale.
Housekeepers.
We don't know where the child was born, said Lucy. But if it was in the city, then chances are there will have been a midwife.
If there was a midwife,
said Nightingale,
there must have been thousands of midwives working in the city 6 years ago. I assume they're registered. But even if we could obtain that register and start checking its members, that sort of investigation can take weeks, months to complete.
But this is a juicy secret, a strange and wonderful story to tell your workmates, said Lucy. I'm a reporter. Take it from me, the midwives will know.
But how do we get them to tell us? I asked.
I don't know how it goes in old London town, he said. But here in Harlem, we go to the fountainhead of all gossip. Alelia Walker, the Queen of Joy herself.
Alelia Walker had a swanky apartment on Edgecombe Avenue and a country mansion in some village north of Yonkers, but her preferred party venue was a pair of Georgian townhouses knocked into one on West 136th Street. The ground floor housed the commodious Walker Hair Parlour, source of a city's worth of gossip, and in the basement was the Lelia College of Beauty Culture, where the next generation of Walker Company beauticians were trained in the arcane science of colored women's hair treatments. It was this business, founded by her mother, that was the source of Alelia Walker's wealth. But not her power, Amelia was to tell me later. Definitely not her power. She was famous for her parties, whose guest list included Harlem poets and Wall Street bankers, hustlers, artists, and famously, a Prince of Sweden who presumably gave her what she was needin'. Although what Alelia Walker might be needing, given her wealth, boggles the mind. Lucy says that he knows what she wanted, but refuses, most unfairly, to tell me. At these parties, princes, paupers, and everybody in between would be rammed into the top three floors of the townhouse like sardines in a tin, provided you liked your sardines marinated in alcohol, that is. Lucy has a standing invitation, but we only went once, and because we were late, we couldn't even get inside. Mrs. Walker was good enough to furnish refreshments to those of us stranded outside, but we both decided that we preferred somewhere where the music wasn't drowned out by the crowd. Alelia received us appropriately enough in the music room, while all around us servants cleared away the debris of the previous night. We'd been lucky to find the house vacant. Some of the parties there could last for days. When we entered, the room had been empty save for a grand piano, but three modern dining chairs were brought in and placed in a row behind us. No sooner had we sat than the great dame herself swept in and we all sprang to our feet. Dancing, or rather slinking, in attendance was none other than Amelia. Alelia Walker was definitely the kind of statuesque beauty that the old Italian painters favoured when depicting Juno reclining with attendant cherubs, although this beauty eschewed the traditional rumpled sheet in favour of a severe, high-necked dress in dark green and a matching silver-green turban. She had a rounded, pleasant face that looked the sort to light up when pleased to see one, but there was none of that beneficence for us. Instead, her dark eyes swept us up and down, while her expression remained that of a woman who has returned home from church to find her parlour full of encyclopedia salesmen.
"You must be the famous Thomas Nightingale," she said. "Sit, sit. Lucien and Augustus we know, of course."
We sat, but she remained standing, as did Amelia.
"You all know my secretary, Amelia," she said. "Now, gentlemen, what is it you are here for?"
Nightingale outlined our situation, and while he omitted references to enchantment and magic, I gained the strongest impression that Lady Alelia knew enough to read between the lines. Certainly she didn't ask why the saxophone was important, or what was special about Morel. When Nightingale had finished, Lady Alelia turned to Amelia, who shrugged.
"This is New York, Mr. Nightingale. We do things our own way here," she said. "We allow Gussie to stay because he's entertaining and mostly harmless, but you have quickly worn out your welcome. There's a balance between the seen and the unseen worlds, which you have already upset. There are men in Virginia, Philadelphia, and Washington who are opposed to colored people taking any control for themselves. So far, we have deafened them with jazz and dazzled them with dancing girls. But should they come against us..."
Lady Alelia shrugged.
"Let us just say it would be better if you caught the next steamer home."
"Nothing would please me more, ma'am,"
said Nightingale.
"But not without seeing Morel safe first."
"There are thousands of females kept in bondage in your own empire," said Alelia. "Perhaps your lofty principles will be better applied there."
"You mistake me, ma'am,"
said Nightingale.
"I am not acting out of principle. A dear friend has asked me to act because she cannot. My motives are entirely personal."
"I see," said Lady Alelia. "That I can appreciate at least. Still, the SS de Grasse is sailing for Le Havre first thing Monday. I suggest you make sure you're on board.
And if I am not?
Asked Nightingale.
Then I will inform the Virginians you are here, said Lady Alelia. That should serve as a distraction, and if you are half as good as your reputation suggests, it will thin out their ranks. Amelia gave a particularly low and unfeminine chuckle.
I didn't come here to start a war,
said Nightingale. It's your choice, Mr. Nightingale, she said. But if it will speed you on your way...
She looked at Amelia again.
Do you think the wise women will be having a party tonight?
It's a Friday, ain't it? Said Amelia. What do you think?
As Amelia explained it to me, because the landlords knew that the colored folk couldn't get lodgings in the white neighborhoods, they could charge more than twice the normal rent. Since colored folk mostly got paid half of what a white worker got, people in Harlem were nearly always short on the rent. To bridge the gap, the good citizens of Harlem had taken to holding rent parties in which private homes were turned into temporary nightclubs at 25 cents per guest. Cram enough people in, sell enough hooch and enough food, and even after expenses and paying the entertainment, you could clear a month's rent, maybe two. The wise women will be having a party, no question, Amelia assured me. There'll be hundreds of rent parties tonight. We just need to find the right one. We, in this instance, meant Amelia and I on our own. Lucy had first called upon his physician neighbor, to no avail, before heading off with Nightingale to do a tour of the city hospitals on the off chance they might find a lead, as the mystery novels frequently say.
And better that the Nightingale is elsewhere for this, said Amelia. I guarantee where we're going, a man like that walks in the front door, everybody we want to talk to will be out down the fire escape.
Now, I've never been accused of excessive pride, but I couldn't help but be miffed at the implications.
I suppose nobody rates me as a threat at all, I said, which sounded bally silly to my own ears, even as I said it.
No, they don't, she said, but everybody's genuinely pleased to see you, and for a rich white Englishman, that's a remarkable feat, don't you think?
How do we find the right party? I asked, as we turned off the great wide boulevard of 7th Avenue onto a narrow cross-town street.
The invitations, said Amelia.
There was no point in having a rent party if people didn't turn up. And furthermore, you needed people who would pay the 25-cent entrance fee. That did not include your friends and relatives who would expect to mooch in for free. To bring in the numbers, Harlemites would print up cards advertising the party and leave them attached to the elevator cages and shop windows or hand them out on Lenox Avenue. Find the right invitation card and we would find the right party we were looking for.
Now we could run around all over town, said Amelia, picking up as many cards as we can and hoping we will find the right one, or...
We came to a halt by a hand-drawn cart, one of the many that plied their trade along the street, sharpening knives, fixing pans, or buying or selling scrap. This one had a mechanical whatnot with a large handle. Bent over the machine was a shabbily dressed white man, with his coat off and sleeves rolled up to reveal ink-stained hands and forearms.
Howdy, Jack, said Amelia. Can I have a look at the samples?
Or you could track down the famous wayside printer who just about printed all the invites and ask to see the samples he kept aside from every job. He seemed to know Amelia well and handed over a wooden fruit box half filled with brightly coloured cards. She thrust the box into my hands and started sorting through them. They were a gay collection of invitations, although I did wonder if there were any railwaymen involved in the railwayman's ball at Candy's place, or whether any card games would figure in the social whist party given by Penny and Epps and offering good food and refreshments. In fact, there were a number of cards that featured a social whist party, and I began to conceive that there might be further hidden meaning contained in the wording. I expressed this to Amelia, who laughed and said that, for coloured folks, there was always another meaning to everything.
Here's one for you, she said, and held up a pink card that read, Mr. Jelly Roll.
The boys are back in town. Refreshment, dancing, company. I'm not sure I understand what you're getting at. Amelia tossed the card into the box. You better ask Lucy about that one, she said, and resumed her rummaging. Soon afterwards, she held up a card on yellow stock with Baby Is As Baby Does, Put Your Mind at Ease with the Old Bone, then an address on West 117th Street. Now we're trucking, said Amelia. Since she was insistent that nobody who is anybody arrives at a rent party before midnight, I took leave of her and headed back to the flat. I keep a change of necessaries and at least two shirts at Lucy's, but wearing the same suit on consecutive days seemed a wholly unnecessary mortification. The flat was mercifully devoid of nightingales, and Beauregard assured me that there had been no callers, especially those of a constabulary persuasion. A bath, a nap, a light supper, and finally a phone call from Lucy in Queens, where they were checking the local maternity hospital. I informed him of my plans and that I would return to his flat once our business was done.
Take care,
he said.
Don't let Amelia lead you astray.
I didn't need the beautiful hands of Monsieur Chastain to know something was rummy about this particular rent party. There were rather more females than I was expecting, and the men that were in attendance stood against the walls or congregated in the out-of-the-way corners of the room. The women danced with each other to a slow, almost funereal trombone solo, while somewhere in the darkness a hand drummer was beating out a steady, pulsing rhythm. The air was heavy with sweat and perfume, fried chicken and tobacco smoke, bathtub gin and neediness. There was no doubt that I had stepped deep into the demi-monde, and I hardly needed Amelia's hissed instructions to keep quiet and follow her lead. Amelia had picked me up at Washington Square in a flivver she said she borrowed from Mall Street. Just to be safe, we left it on St. Nicholas Avenue, where someone was, according to Amelia, bound to borrow it again. Thence to the address, where we'd negotiated five flights of stairs, although we could hear the party from the ground floor up. Are all these ladies midwives? I asked. Look closer, said Amelia. Tell me what you see. I have to say that there are certain aspects of femininity that I admit to being less than familiar with. Shall we say the earthier, more family-orientated aspects? But even I could see that some of what I'd taken for stoutness was something else entirely. I see, I said. Many of these ladies are with child. Well done, Gussie, said Amelia. They bring food, money, occasionally jewellery, as a down payment on a safe delivery. Offerings, I said. But to whom? I suppose you could say the midwives, said Amelia, in a collective sort of way. Does it work? Amelia shrugged. Who knows? I was about to ask whether we were any closer to our goal when a round lady in a teal shift slid up to us, and before I could stop her, she put her bare brown arms around my neck and kissed me on the lips.
Who's this?
She asked Amelia. This is Gussie, said Amelia, Lucien's gentleman. To my great relief, the lady let go of my neck and stepped back to give me the old up and down while clucking her tongue. I'm flattered to say with approval.
I birthed him, you know, she said. Lucky Lucien. Came out easy. His mama hardly felt a thing.
She gave me an affectionate pat on the cheek.
Still lucky now.
The lady turned suddenly to Amelia, and seizing both her hands, pulled her close so that the girl was pressed against the woman's ample bosom.
What is it you want?
She said.
Don't tell me you're in the family way.
Amelia put her arms around the woman's waist and began to dance, swaying against the older woman to the long, slow slide of the trombone. I want a story, Auntie, she said.
What kind of story, baby?
The one about a special princess who fell into wicked company.
What kind of wicked company?
The trumpet-playing soldier boy kind.
That wicked, eh?
The worst, but he's not important to the story.
Since you're asking me for this story, I'm going to say the man was a little bit important.
The woman Amelia called Auntie caught my eye and winked.
If only in passing.
So, in despair, the princess fell in with the wicked Baron of the Gold Coast, who locked her in a tower.
That wicked old white man,
said Auntie.
Shame.
But we don't know whether the princess had a child or not.
What kind of fairy story is that?
The kind we ain't finished with yet, said Amelia. You wouldn't have heard a piece of that story, would you, Auntie?
There's a child,
said Auntie.
A beautiful child, with skin like old ivory and hair like a wire brush. They dragged me all the way out to Nassau County and that big ugly house. They knew I was the best, but even so, it was close. Princess or kitchen mechanic, they all holler the same when the time comes. And this one was a biter. Damn near took my fingers off when I tried to reason with her. The poor child was presenting face down, and it took me 5 hours to coax her out. She came out yelling, too. Didn't wait for me to smack her.
Amelia stopped dancing and stood away from Auntie, her eyes searching the woman's face.
Do you reckon she's still alive?
I do,
said Auntie.
But you might want to leave her where she is. She's going to need some powerful protection to make her way in the world.
Why's that?
She had eyes like a goat,
said Auntie.
Scared the shit out of me when I saw them the first time. Devil's eyes.